we're back. Hey, James.
What's up, Emily? How you doing?
Pretty good.
Pretty good?
Pretty good.
It's another sunny, beautiful day here in California.
Yep. Wishing all our listeners the same in their respective cities and towns.
Yeah, we're in the middle
countries.
Well, I guess the start of fall for certain areas. So
yeah. I love fall.
I do too. It's the leaves are my favorite thing.
My favorite part is the sweaters.
The sweaters?
Yeah, I mean, leaves are beautiful, but my favorite part is the big, chunky sweaters that is like walking around with a blanket on.
Say that, okay, but I don't know why, but it makes me think of apple cider, which is also my favorite part of fall.
I think that's your Michigan roots coming through.
Yes, yes.
Whereas for me, we don't really, I mean, there are cider mills in the South, I assume, but it's not like part of the culture, one might say. So it's more just like, get your blankets, sit on a porch, in a rocking chair.
Absolutely.
And do something.
So guys, this week we wanted to talk about a very serious topic. I think it affects
complex.
Very complex. You know, according to a national survey on drug use and health, 21.5 million American adults aged 12 and older battle with a substance use disorder. And that was in 2014. So, you know, this is something that's going on. It's been going on for years. And it's been titled the opioid epidemic.
Right.
And, you know, we have a lot of questions about it, and I'm sure a lot of people have as well. And so we kind of wanted to just throw it into the wind and see who would be able to talk to us about this and give us some more information. And we got very lucky.
Yeah, we got this amazing man named Dr. John Brooklyn, who really does an excellent job walking us through the roots of this epidemic, when it started, which was way earlier than I thought it was.
Absolutely.
And giving us a good historical perspective, but also a couple examples about what's working as far as solutions moving forward. So stay tuned, and we're excited for you to hear from Dr. John. Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of We Rebel. We're really excited because we emailed this amazing person out of the blue and he responded. So this week we have Dr. John Brooklyn on the podcast, and I have four positions that I'd like to credit him with. He is the medical director of the Howard Center Chittenden Clinic, which I just learned is a county in Vermont. He is also the medical director of Baymark St. Albans Clinic. He has a staff position at the Community Health Centers of Burlington. And he's a clinical assistant professor of family medicine and psychiatry at the University of Vermont Medical College. Whoa. John, hello. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
We're great, and we're just so honored to speak to someone of such a high caliber about this issue. You know, we were talking a little bit before we started here. You know, the opioid epidemic is something that's presented as very scary, especially because there are a lot of facts that we don't know. We get pushed a lot of numbers of saying this many people are affected by this, and, you know, this many people are succeeding and this many people are dying. And I think there's a lot of history behind what this epidemic is. And so when we reached out to you, we were hoping to learn a little bit more about where this started and, you know, where we're going. So if you don't mind, give us a little bit of history about the opioid epidemic and how it came to be.
Sure. Well, thanks. I think we ought to go back in time a little bit, only because people have to realize that humans' interaction with opiates goes back millennia. And probably the first time someone came across a poppy that had sap oozing from it, or they cut it and they tasted it and used it and absorbed it, probably didn't realize how potent opium is. And historically, we've been using it for thousands of years, mostly from the Indus Valley, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran area. But really, in the 1850s, around the time of both the Civil War and the Crimean War, chemists were able to take opium, which was usually smoked or taken in an elixir of some sort, and began to extract chemicals from it that were much more potent than opium. And the first one that was extracted was morphine. And morphine was the first opiate used anesthetically to treat battle wounds during the Civil War and the Crimean War. And what happened, because of the way that our brains are wired is that people began to take opium for pain and then over time became physically dependent on it. And I'll go into that in a minute. But after the Civil War, many soldiers were left with morphine dependency. And there was a disease that was actually called the soldier's disease. And what would happen is if you took morphine for a period of time and then you stopped taking it, you would get sick. So people became physically dependent to it. Now, at the time in the United States, the morphine and codeine were able to be taken both intravenously because the hypodermic needle had been invented, or orally. But most people used it intravenously, and people would go to their doctor and they would get it prescribed. In some cases, especially in New England, there were apothecaries and general stores that would prepare you different elixirs of morphine or opium. And at one time in the United States, patent medicines, which came out of England, had fairly high quantities of opium in it. But be that as it may, we had a very robust use of opiates in the United States, further enhanced by the railroad workers who often came from the Orient to help build our railroads. They had a custom of smoking opium. So the combination of opium smoking in certain areas of the country and the combination of morphine use led to some concern in the government. And in fact, heroin, which was developed in the 1870s, 1880s, and was actively advertised by the Bayer Corporation, who also figured out how to make aspirin. So people thought that heroin was going to be an antidote to morphine use, and it was also prescribed as a cough medicine. But what happened is that people began to inject heroin and found that it gave them a very robust effect, primarily because of the way the molecule was structured. When you take morphine or codeine or even opium, it's slowly absorbed into the body. But intravenous heroin, when it's injected, gets to the brain in about 10 seconds. And it causes parts of the brain to become very activated faster than the other opioids. So people who use heroin intravenously can very quickly become euphoric on it and then develop dependence within actually sometimes a matter of weeks. So in the early 20th century in the United States, there was enough concern about the number of people using heroin, using morphine, that a law was passed called the Harrison Act. And the Harrison Act made it illegal for a doctor to prescribe opiates to people who were known to be physically dependent. At the time, they called it addicted, physically dependent on morphine or heroin. So in 1914, almost overnight, you had a cohort of people who were regularly using opiates who suddenly became unable to get their supply and then had to resort to illegal activities in order to get opiates. Mm-hmm. So from that point on in the United States, we've had illegality of heroin has been a major factor in incarceration and all the things that go along with illicit use. And there really was no treatment for people who were heroin dependent. They would either use it and get sick if they didn't get it or continue to use it. And then as the potency of heroin increased over time, especially in the 1950s and 1960s, people could overdose on it. So you had this situation in the States of long-term users, physically dependent, nowhere to go, criminal activity. And it was really one of these situations that in many cases was epidemic in proportion, but didn't really get the attention that it needed because people who used heroin were considered to be common criminals, or they were ethnic or racial minorities. And so the government didn't really pay a lot of attention to it until the 1960s. And in the mid-60s, there was a wave of heroin overdoses in New York City. And a doctor named Dr. Vincent Dole, in concert with his colleague Marie Niswander, began to do research. They were asked by the Department of Health in New York to do research and discovered that a drug called methadone, which was a opiate analgesic, a medicine that was used for pain from the 1930s, was very effective in stopping people from using heroin. And the reason for that is that when you use heroin, it doesn't last very long in your body and it wears off. And we have in our brains a chemical called an endorphin, which is an internal opiate. So our brains are sort of wired to produce this compound that mimics that of opium in the natural world. So because of that, when people begin to use opiates for a period of time, they shut down a certain receptor that makes adrenaline. And when that drug, opium, is no longer in the brain, the adrenaline gets released and people go through what we call withdrawal, which is a surge of adrenaline causing sweating and anxiety and blood pressure elevation and achiness and diarrhea and all the things that go along with it. So that if they take the opiates again, that goes away. So that's a cycle of using and getting high, but then being sick can continue for some people for months or years, and people are pretty much maintaining themselves and trying to be well. So with heroin, what happens is it's so fast acting, and then it leaves the brain so quickly, it begins to change the way that the brain operates. It hijacks the natural process so that people have a very difficult time stopping. You know, you probably have heard many people say, well, you know, you should just be able to stop using heroin on your own. But we know from research, of decades of research and PET scans and MRIs, that heroin dependence becomes a brain disorder, a chronic brain disorder. And if you look at the natural history of someone who tries to stop using heroin, they're beset by relapse. They try to stop, they go to rehab, they come out, and they resume use again. And people who've never had this problem don't understand why, except for the major understanding that the brain fundamentally changes. So this concept back in the 60s of using methadone, which is a long-acting opioid, to treat heroin dependence was originally met with skepticism. But what was found is that a once-a-day dose of methadone given, because it's so long-lasting, would stop people from using heroin. In fact, if you got on a dose that was sufficient to block the cravings, you could actually block the effects of heroin if someone injected. So this revolutionary treatment became acceptable in the United States. Methadone programs were open. They were opened around the world. And in fact, methadone treatment is considered one of the World Health Organization's essential medications around the world that is necessary, because even though it's not perfect, even though it doesn't stop everybody from using, people who are on methadone can suddenly normalize their brain. The craving for heroin goes away. The risk of overdose goes away. And many people went on to lead absolutely normal, fruitful, effective lives while they're on methadone. Many people have tried to come off of methadone and often relapse because the brain changes are still there. And so they often have to go back onto to methadone. The issue with methadone treatment, though, is that it's fairly restrictive in the United States. Other countries have less restrictions, but people have to go to a clinic every day and be dosed, and eventually will receive take-homes. And because of the success in many programs, especially the one in New York, of stabilizing people who are on methadone for long periods of time, doctors began to realize that you could just be maintained on methadone indefinitely, just like any other chronic disease, just like diabetes or hypertension. You may need to take medication the rest of your life. But because of the restrictions around methadone clinics, many areas did not have clinics, or many patients elected not to go because of the hassle of having to go every day. So in the 90s, when we had a wave of, when we had an HIV epidemic, which was another epidemic in many ways linked to IV drug use, the federal government decided that an alternative to methadone needed to be promoted. And we at University of Vermont and other places around the country had been researching a medication called buprenorphine. And buprenorphine is different than methadone in that it is also a medication that blocks the effects of heroin, but it has a ceiling effect, meaning that if you took a lot of buprenorphine, you would not have sedation or potential overdose like can occur with methadone. So because of the safety profile, the government began to look at an alternative to going to a clinic and began to think about treating opiate use disorder in the office, just like any other chronic medical disease. So we at UVM had been doing research for about a dozen years, and when buprenorphine finally became available in 2002, we began to embrace it as an alternative to methadone in the United States. Now, if you remember, I mentioned briefly this Harrison Act of 1914. What had to happen is we had to reverse that law by a congressional act called DATA 2000, Drug Abuse Treatment Act, in which the federal government said, okay, docs, we told you in 1914 that we'd throw you in jail if you treated heroin users in your office. Now we're saying it's okay to do it. But guess what? You've got to take a training to prescribe this medication because it's new and it's novel. So they required doctors to take an 8-hour training to prescribe buprenorphine, and they made docs limited to only 30 people that they could treat at any one time. So in 2002, the alternative to methadone was allowed, and there were a certain cohort of us in the United States who took the training and began to use buprenorphine. Now, one of the problems that existed in the U.S. is that some states didn't even have methadone treatment, and Vermont was one of those states. So in 2002, there were still 8 states in the U.S. that did not have any methadone programs. Vermont decided to open its first methadone program in Burlington, the largest city, in 2002, and right around the same time, buprenorphine became available. If you think about going to a methadone program, they usually set in large cities where there's a certain cohort of heroin users, and people didn't really think that a state like Vermont in northeast part of the United States, or maybe even New Hampshire or Maine, would have much of an opiate problem. And for a while, we didn't. We were mostly alcohol users, but there was always this undercurrent of opiate use that goes back about 100 years in Vermont, where people would use opium, they would use the morphine products. But for a while, it went underground. And then, as you all know, in the late 90s, oxycodone was manufactured into a long-acting form of OxyContin. So we actually had a much greater problem with prescription opiate use, as did much of the Northeast and much of the country, than we did heroin for a period of time. I think the other thing that people need to understand is that the cartels from Mexico and Colombia began to bring in higher potency heroin than we previously had seen. So people didn't necessarily have to be IV users of heroin. They could use it intranasally. And so there was a bit more acceptance of heroin use here when people didn't feel like they had to inject it. So the storm of heroin coming in of higher purity, not needing to be injected, OxyContin beginning to be prescribed regularly by docs, gave us a situation we really had to deal with, so that by 2002, we had to start opening programs. Because of the work we've done at UVM, though, the state of Vermont decided they wanted to promote buprenorphine as an alternative to methadone because there was only one methadone clinic. And so we began to train doctors in the state to prescribe buprenorphine. And at one point, we had more docs in Vermont prescribing buprenorphine than any other state in the country, which was good in that you could be in a very rural city, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people with no methadone program for 80 miles away, and you could go to your doctor who would prescribe you buprenorphine, and you could go to the pharmacy and pick it up and you would take it, and the doctor would manage your opiate addiction in the office instead of you having to go to a clinic. So we really had kind of two systems operating. We had a large buprenorphine program throughout the state, and we also had these scattered methadone programs around the state. Now, being both the medical director of a methadone program and a community health physician using buprenorphine, it became apparent that even though docs got the training to prescribe buprenorphine, they may not have had the skill to deal with all the things that come along with an addictive disorder, meaning certain behaviors and the different things that people brought to the practice in terms of depression or anxiety or their mental health issues or even their physical issues of hepatitis or HIV. So we began to realize that we needed to create a system that would support physicians in the prescribing of buprenorphine so that they didn't feel overwhelmed. And from there, we created this program called the Hub and Spoke, whereby we would create these regional centers that were methadone programs. We would call them hubs. And the programs could have both methadone and buprenorphine as options, so that if a community physician was having difficulty with a patient, they could refer that person to the hub for ongoing treatment with buprenorphine or even methadone and not abandon the patient. So the idea was to take a disease, heroin use or opiate use, that was kind of outside the mainstream because most methadone programs are not linked to anything medical in the United States, and make it part of our healthcare system so that people who had this chronic disease could be treated both in the office or at a regional center, and people wouldn't lose their treatment. So the goal was kind of a seamless transition, just like somebody who had heart disease, who had hypertension and high cholesterol, who continued to smoke. If they had a heart attack, they'd go to the hospital. You wouldn't say to that person, I'm not taking care of you anymore because you smoke. We created that same system in Vermont with the hub and spoke.
Wow. So real quick, I have to first say, I feel like I need a interactive room that can help me travel both through time and issue area to fully understand everything you just said. It's like, is there any sort of resource that is like, I mean, that is so much information that when we hear something like a random stat that is so isolated out of that ecosystem, it's hard to even make a judgment call on what those statistics mean.
Yes, correct. There's 100 years of information.
Yep.
In terms of, there's some really good resources. There's books that have been written. There's journal articles, hundreds of journal articles on this topic. I'm just giving you sort of a short synopsis of
sure.
it.
Yeah, there's volumes you could speak about this. And actually, you mentioned morphine earlier, and this is a quick anecdote, but my appendix ruptured when I was about 12, I think. And to deal with the pain, they had me on morphine. And I think I remember having a button for that. Now, I was only on this morphine for maybe, I want to say 4 days, maybe five. Within that time, right before I was about to be released from the hospital, they took me off the morphine. And within a half hour, I was scratching my entire body because I felt my skin crawling. And of course, like the nurses, had to calm me down and say, okay, you're just going through withdrawal. And that was after what, 5 days of it just being, and that's just me in the hospital. So imagine these people out on the streets, we talk about addiction and it has this negative stigma, but as you were saying, it affects their brain. It affects their everyday living to the point that they are dependent on these things. And so it's so wonderful that you came up with this model, because you said something so wonderful about how they, some of these people get just thrown to the side. They lose their care where they should have continuous physical and emotional support on these things. They need to see a physician. They need to see someone that's regularly checking up on them and making sure that they have a place to go to get that treatment. So it's great that this model was put in place. So tell us about, how it was working in Vermont. And also, is this something that other states have been using?
Yeah. So one of the things that's interesting is that, like I said, Vermont came late to the party in terms of treatment of opiate use disorder. We were one of the last holdouts until 2002. So many states have got long embedded methadone clinics, methadone programs with all the social stigma associated with it. And many doctors have been waivered to prescribe buprenorphine, but have never taken the step to actually prescribe for the first patient. And I think part of it comes down to fear. So there's a lot of fear about, what do I do if this person doesn't follow the rules? Or what do I do if this person gets sick when I'm treating them? Or what do I do if the person needs more support than I can give? And so part of what happened is in Vermont, the Department of Health and the state created what's called the Blueprint for Health. And they looked at chronic diseases like diabetes and congestive heart failure. And they knew that it takes a team to treat diabetes. It takes a team to treat people with congestive heart failure. You need nurses, you need nurse practitioners, you need doctors, you need social workers, you need dietitians, you need exercise therapists. And so why should we think that it would be any different in taking care of someone who is a heroin user, who has had a lot of their life disrupted either through crime or illness or social isolation? And so the concept was that we need to create a system identical to that which we treat other diseases. And so they designated opiate use disorder as a chronic disease. And in 2011, I walked into the health department and I said, hey, you know, I have this crazy idea about this concept called the hub and spoke, which we would, like I mentioned, we would start people in the hub and they would go to the spoke, or they'd be in the spoke and they could go to the hub, but we need to figure out how to do it. And so smarter people than me came up with a model for how to make it work. And part of what happened is that with the Affordable Care Act, there was a section in the Affordable Care Act that allowed for the creation of health homes. And so what the state of Vermont did is they designated doctor's offices as spokes and methadone programs as hubs, and designated them both as specialty health homes or medical health homes in order to leverage a certain amount of money from our expanded Medicaid state plan amendment so that we could draw down funding to pay for additional support for the doctors. So for instance, if you were a buprenorphine prescriber, the state gave you a full-time equivalent registered nurse and a full-time equivalent licensed master's level clinician for every 100 patients that you treated at no cost to you. Hmm. So if I'm a doctor in a rural town and I have a small practice and I have 20 buprenorphine patients, somebody's going to show up once a week to help me manage those folks. And when I say manage, I mean do things like collect urine tests, deal with little crises around medication management. Maybe they need a prior authorization. Perhaps they need some help with housing or transportation or legal issues. So all of those things that the doc could never do and often didn't want to do and was afraid that they were going to have to do were now done by other team members so that the doc could do the business of prescribing and managing the medical conditions. Mm-hmm. And so what we had in the state is we had a lot of doctors who had very few patients. The waivers for buprenorphine is in the first year you can treat 30. In the second year, you can apply to the federal government to treat 100 people at one time. And after 2 years of demonstrating competence, you can actually apply to increase to 275 people. And those limits were recently raised by the CARA Act of 2016, which allowed docs to increase their waiver to 275. So with that happening, what our intent was if we gave the docs these resources, would they increase the total number of people that they treated? And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Mm. I wrote a paper in 2017 published in the Journal of Addiction Medicine that laid out the actual increases. And we had something like a 54% increase in the number of docs who got waivered to prescribe and almost a 60% increase in the number who were prescribing close to their limit. So what we achieved is so many doctors prescribing for patients on buprenorphine and increasing the hubs, which also got resources to do this, that Vermont suddenly was treating about 8,000 people with either methadone or buprenorphine as of June 2018. Now, that number may not seem like a lot, but if you look at the national statistics, which say it is about 1% of the U.S. population has an opiate use disorder that needs treatment, that's 2.4 million people, okay?
Wow.
So that 1% number is important. However, 8,000 out of 500,000 adults in Vermont is 1.6% of the population. So we are currently treating almost 60% more than what is predicted on a federal level, and we think we're only treating about 50% of people. Hmm. So that means that there may be up to 3% of the population in our state who need treatment with either methadone or buprenorphine. And that blows those numbers of predicted by the feds completely out of the water.
Yep.
So when you look at the number of people in treatment, a lot of it has to do with the fact that our state amended their state plan amendment to make treatment on demand, make treatment available, and made it paid for by insurance. Now, you contrast that with the state next door, New Hampshire, which doesn't have expanded Medicaid, or Maine, which doesn't have expanded Medicaid, and you look at their overdose rates. Mm. Vermont has one of the four lowest overdose rates in the United States. A recent CDC release that was published in the New York Times last week showed that we're the only state in the Northeast, actually on the entire Eastern Seaboard, that has had a almost 15% reduction in overdose deaths. we've had our neighbors next door have 10 and 15% increase in overdose. And I'm not trying to brag or crow about this. Sure. I think it's tragic that other states have not expanded treatments like we have, because with easy access and no waiting lists at all for treatment in the state, people know that if they want help, help is available. And for me, as a doctor, I believe help equals either methadone or buprenorphine, because we know that those drugs keep people from overdosing and dying. And when we talk about this epidemic, we have to include fentanyl. The reason so many people are dying is the introduction of this much more potent opioid called fentanyl, which is used for pain. But tiny amounts of it find their way into the heroin supply, and people don't know it, and they overdose and die. So from my perspective, when you're in the midst of an epidemic where people are dying left and right, it's all hands on deck, and you have to expand access to treatment no matter where you are, which is what we've done in Vermont. So those numbers, I think, tell the story of what happens when a state decides to expand access so that nobody has to wait, and leverage a certain way to increase doctors prescribing so that they feel comfortable doing it. We see the results in the number of people in treatment and a reduction in our overdose rate.
I'm so glad you brought up fentanyl, because the other side of this epidemic is the access to these drugs. We already know heroin is one of the cheapest drugs and is also one of the most accessible anyway. And so now the fentanyl is making its way into prescription pills, into heroin, things like that. You know, there's so much easy access. So if you know anything about this other side, then why is it so easy for people to get these things? Why is it so cheap? And also on the for the doctors that are prescribing these things, why are we over prescribing people to the point that they do become addicted to these things?
Well, a lot of it, that's a great question. So let me try to tease some of it out. Now, I'm not an opiate user, but I've interviewed a lot of opiate users, and people are, you know, usually of the opinion fentanyl kind of snuck its way in there. It wasn't anything that people expected to happen. But we see a lot of people who are not testing positive for heroin anymore because it's just fentanyl in their bags. So part of it is a public education to let people know that fentanyl is in heroin. It's actually finding its way into crack cocaine. So people who are merely cocaine users are now overdosing and dying because of fentanyl being added. And as you mentioned, it's finding its way into fake benzodiazepines and fake opiates. So why a cartel would want to add fentanyl to the drug supply with the likelihood of killing its customers, I do not know. All I know is that it's very potent, a little bit goes a long way, and it's much easier to smuggle into the United States. I'm told that most of the fentanyl in the U.S. comes from China. I don't know if that's true, but we certainly make a lot of fentanyl in the United States. I don't know how much of it's diverted, but small amounts go a long way. And I think what happens is that because it's so cheap, you can add it and reduce the overall price of a bag of heroin, as you say. And it is pretty inexpensive. I mean, people can pay $2 or $3 for a bag of heroin now, and it used to be $20, $30, $40. So the price point has gotten so low, and it's so available that people use it. Now, in terms of prescribing practices, I think myself included, the medical profession was in many ways and I'll use the word strongly, hoodwinked into believing that opioids were without risk. There was a great article in the New Yorker in January of this year about the Sackler family from Purdue Pharma and all of the ways that they manipulated information for doctors to think that OxyContin was a safe drug to prescribe. And you had so much of it being prescribed for so long because we were told that people couldn't become addicted to it, that we created, in many ways, a greater problem than used to exist. If you look at the statistics from the 90s during the HIV epidemic, it was thought there were about 1 million daily heroin users, and that number remained pretty constant over a decade. But now there's estimates of 5 to 6 million people with opiate use disorder, mainly because of prescription pills. And we've got much more of a problem because that million number was the target for buprenorphine and methadone to try to get all those people treated. But now when you increase that by a factor of 5, you can see how treatment just begins to slip backwards. You just don't have enough slots to treat everybody. So the overprescribing is being dealt with slowly. I mean, our state of Vermont now has guidelines for doctors prescribing pain medications, and there's there's other states who are taking the lead. But I think there's an unintended consequence, because one of the things I believe has happened is as the number of pills have been reduced and the number of prescribers have been reduced, people who get cut off from their opiates will often turn to heroin, with the consequence of being fentanyl exposed. So you have many people who originally maintained on pills who now don't have access to them anymore and are turning to the cheap white powder, which has been the case for a long time, but it's even more so now. And so I think if we're going to have a reduction in the overall supply, you have to have treatment to meet that.
Yep.
And why that treatment hasn't been met yet is, again, I think doctors feel burned about prescribing opiates, and now you're telling them to go ahead and treat with buprenorphine. I think they're a little gun shy in that regard. So there's still a lot of work that has to happen to make more treatment available for people who become dependent on opiates. The other thing I've seen happen more and more, which is even more shocking, is that we have a lot of people who are chronically maintained on opiates and were probably doing fine with them for chronic pain. They were taking them as prescribed. They weren't using them illicitly. But if their doctors get scared about prescribing and they say, I'm not prescribing for you anymore. And I've had some elderly folks end up on my doorstep at some of the methadone programs who were just cut off that day, abandoned by their physician, who were seeking treatment at a methadone program, which is really kind of designed for heroin users. And, you know, I got grandmas coming in line and getting methadone and buprenorphine now because they've lost their opiate prescription. So there's a significant effect, chilling effect, on just, you know, the overprescribing and now the underprescribing of opiates. It'd be nice if we could hit a happy balance.
Absolutely. And I'm curious, you touched on it briefly when you were talking about the hub and spoke model, but also I assume associated with treatment is cost, you know, and the cost has got to go somewhere, whether it's insurance, whether it's federal government subsidized, like it, someone's paying for it. So, you know, how is that piece of the puzzle affecting the treatment options available?
So that's a great question. In Vermont, the first 8 quarters of the hub and spoke, the money that was leveraged to pay for the MAT team that I mentioned, that nurse and the master's level, and the case managers and the hubs, that was a 90-10 or a 70-30 split from the feds and the state. So for the first 8 quarters, there was a match. However, after 8 quarters, our cost savings was so significant that the state of Vermont decided to self-fund the program thereafter. So for the last 5 years, before 3 years, we've been self-funding. So as an example, if you look at the cost of someone who has a diagnosis of opiate use disorder, let's say they went to the ER, they had an overdose, or they got admitted with an abscess or something, and they were coded somewhere as opiate use disorder. If you track that individual through the system and you look at their cost to the system, you get an idea of what their annual per capita cost of healthcare is. So from 2011 to 2017, we have cost analysis that show the difference if you have opiate use disorder and you're not on medication-assisted treatment. The average cost is between $12,000 to $15,000 a year to treat that individual. And a lot of that has to do with emergency room costs, maybe infections, something like that. If you then look at people who are on either methadone and buprenorphine and you track their cost, excluding the cost of the MAT, the cost is somewhere between $7,000 and $8,000 a year. So there's a tremendous difference between the healthcare cost of someone in treatment versus not in treatment. And if you factor in the MAT cost, it's still about $2,000 to $3,000 per person per year less than it is if they're not in treatment. So the savings is threefold. One is you're saving on people dying and the cost of the system of taking care of that situation. You're taking care of a lot of social costs by keeping people out of prison and helping people get back to work and maintain their family. And you're also taking care of a medical cost, because when people come into treatment, they then take care of their hepatitis C and their smoking and their obesity and their depression. All those things take care of. So we've actually demonstrated significant cost savings that continue to this day, even though we're treating as many people as I mentioned.
Sure. And also, I mean, I think a lot of what you just touched on is the other cascading effects that, you know, then reinforce the economics of this decision. Like, if someone can go back to work, like, for all we know, that person is an entrepreneur that's going to be creating jobs. I mean, there's so many narratives that are immeasurable, but nonetheless going to happen as a cascading effect of this pivot in their life. And so I'm curious, you know, so you have these cost analysis and this model. And so circling back to or touching on James's earlier question, you know, what other states are beginning to test it?
So the state of California last year in 2000. So, you know, there was all this STR money, the Congress allocated money to states to deal with the opioid epidemic in 2016, again in 2017. So the current estimate is that 58% of all that money, all the cures money, has gone to looking at the hub and spoke model around the country.
Great.
And
so what that means is that many states are taking a look at it. So California last year adopted a hub and spoke model in 19 of their 57 counties. Colorado is looking at adopting it. They've adopted it on a smaller scale in certain communities, especially the Denver area, Denver Health in the Denver area. We have work right now with Wisconsin, which is exploring the establishment of a hub and spoke model. We have smaller groups. We have people who are looking at more regionalized systems. So places in Pennsylvania, places in New York, places in Maryland are kind of collaborating with each other. So rather than having a whole statewide program, they may say, okay, let's take Binghamton or let's take, you know, Pittsburgh, and there's some programs there. Let's join forces with the specialty clinics, the methadone programs, and create these regional centers of excellence. Now let's link it with community doctors. So you're starting to see this idea of bringing more and more treatment into primary care and linking it with specialty centers, which is really kind of revolutionary in this work because, again, these folks with this disorder are always kind of marginalized, and bringing them into normal medical care and treating them like the humans that they are should not be a revolutionary idea, but apparently it is. And so as it catches on, more and more states are trying to look at how to incorporate. We have a lot of people coming to Vermont from all over the country who are looking at the model. And again, I don't know what phase they're in, but there's Washington State, Oregon, Nevada, Georgia, Louisiana. I mean, I could just go on the number of states that are starting to look at it.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's great to see the states are getting involved. So then the last real question then is, what is our federal government doing? Like, what is this administration doing to help this problem as well? And is, and if, whether they're taking part in helping the hub and spoke model, or are they doing anything at all?
Well, I think, again, I'm not sure. I know that there was the presidential commission, and I know that Chris Christie, who headed it, really believed strongly in opiate treatment in New Jersey. They have a pretty robust system while he was governor of treating opiate use disorder. I don't think there's any real stigma associated with that. There's a lot of money that's being thrown at the problem, but I think part of the issue remains that the stigmatization of this disease continues. I also think there's still a tremendous bias by both the public and the medical establishment that medication is just a crutch, and that the idea of using buprenorphine or methadone is still looked upon in many cases as not the standard of care. The standard of care should be you go into a rehab facility, you spend 28 days thumping your chest and talking to other people and doing some good work and then getting out and never using again. And the problem is that the most likely time you're going to overdose and die is when you walk out of a rehab facility because you've lost your tolerance to opiates, you no longer have any in your body, and either your dealer or your friend or your neighbor or you yourself makes that first outreach and you use opiates and you overdose and die because it overwhelms your brain, which is not used to it. So this idea of rehab, as we call it, beds, really has to be replaced by chairs, which is more treatment, more agonist treatment around the country. And I think from a lot of different quarters, that message is resonating, but I don't see on a national level, especially when our former Health and Human Service director thought that buprenorphine and methadone were just crutches, I know the current person doesn't feel that way, and I know that there are a lot of people in government who are still believing that, you know, medication-assisted treatment is important. You're still going to find people who don't believe in that. So you're going to have resistance, I think, for a long time. But people are getting it, and there is a lot of money and funding being set aside for this disorder. How much is needed, I don't know. I'm not in government, but I know that if people want to expand Medicaid in states and really expand the number of people who need treatment, I think that's one of the most important things that could be done so that people without insurance can get access to appropriate care.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's so important to have those resources for these people. And so, you know, Emily and I, we're artists, you know, we're your average 20 somethings. And for the average person out there who, you know, has just learned a lot from you in this past 40 minutes, you know, what can we do? You know, we already talked about getting rid of the stigmatization of this rehabilitation and what drug use is. And, you know, so what are some other things that we can do as an average human being to, you know, end this epidemic?
Well, I think if you have friends or family who, first of all, I think the conversation has to occur around the treatment of pain and the use of opiates. So many people get exposed through painkillers. So I think talking to friends and family about the use of opiates, as you mentioned, James, your experience after only 4 days, the human brain begins to change very quickly in exposure to opiates. So I think getting people away from the idea that taking a pill to treat their pain and treat their ill is a good idea, probably a good place to start, because I think, you know, our society is based on you shouldn't have any pain and there's a pill for it. So helping people understand that these pills can be very harmful, even in the beginning, trying to stay away from them, use alternatives, is a good idea. I think the second thing is to recognize that most people don't wake up one day and say, hey, I think I'll be a heroin addict today. I think it happens to people, especially people who've had trauma in their life, people who have mental health issues, who've been hurt, who've been injured, and understanding with compassion that this is not something that people seek, that happens to them, and try to help them through, or to at least not to look down upon people who have this disorder, I think goes a long way. And I think the other thing is that if you do have friends or family that have problems with substance use disorder, is to help them learn self-compassion, learn that it wasn't necessarily their fault. Yeah, maybe they made the initial decision to snort that pill or, you know, smoke that, whatever. But the fact is that things can happen to the brain that people don't know about, and that they should at least treat themselves with a little more compassion and grace so that they aren't so negative on themselves and down on themselves for this. And that just stand by them as long as you possibly can, because people really do get better. And then also help people seek out help with methadone or buprenorphine, because these drugs really do work and they should be more widely available. And advocating for that and advocating in your communities for more docs and more resources, I think, is also a very important thing to do.
I love that you just pulled this unbelievable, vast ecosystem back to compassion. I think that is so powerful because, you know, I'm not a doctor, but I have many friends in the medical profession. I've had amazing doctors throughout my life because of many reasons, but it is because they are compassionate to whatever's going on with me one-on-one in the patient room. So thank you for that unbelievable description
I've
of
learned
what's
so,
happening.
I've learned so much
I've
in
learned,
this last
I immediately
little bit.
Feel, like,
this
is, I feel brilliant now. Yeah. I'm just going to go out and conquer the world. I think we all are going to, you know, I think it's very helpful to have this understanding as we hear the snippets in the media. So I encourage all of our listeners to dig deeper and keep asking questions and educating themselves as they talk to their family and friends about it.
And change the conversation. Let's change how we view these things and really, you know, have, like we said, have compassion, and let's learn and grow and fix this epidemic. Once again, thank you so much, John. You are a wealth of knowledge, and we really appreciate you being here today.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to go on like that for as long as you let me. Thank you.
Technology is a wonderful thing. You can check Reddit and find the latest news. You can go on Facebook and post a bunch of pictures of your dog, and you can text your friends in an instant. But what if you also had an app that could get your friends to vote? Nassim is here to talk a little bit about Outvote, which is an app that you can put on your phone and get your friends to get out this November.
Hi, I'm Nassim, the CEO of OutVote, and we're an app to get Democrats to go vote. Right now, campaigns spend all their money on ads, emails, and text messages from strangers, and none of it actually gets people to go vote. If you spend, you know, $10,000 on Facebook ads, you get about 60 votes. You spend it on door knocking, you'll get about 300. It's been shown to cost about $31 a vote, door knocking. And without vote, you get over 10,000 votes. Now that number is provided you actually know a few hundred volunteers who know a few thousand people, but that's how effective it is. It's 35 times more effective than door knocking. And we do this by matching your phone contacts to the National Voter Database and telling you which of your friends don't vote. And then we peer pressure them into voting. And it turns out peer pressure works. Our mission this November is to take back the House. And in order to get the volunteers and the reach to do so, we're teaming up with some big organizations like Move On, Indivisible, the Democratic State Parties, and more. Our biggest success to date was probably last November when we first launched and helped elect four Cambridge City Councilors. Three of them were underdogs. And millennials contacted by OutVote were actually about twice as likely to vote than the general population. And non-millennials who we contacted were about 50% more likely. We reached about half the voting population with our efforts. So there are about over 22,000 people voted, I believe. We reached about half those folks. And so that was pretty cool to see. We're running a randomized control study right now, which is a bit more rigorous than our testing last November, so it'll be exciting to see those results as well. And we also had some big successes in the California primaries and actually Connecticut as well. There are some awesome activists in Connecticut. I did not realize that until the primaries this year, but they really took to the OutVote app and sent a ton of messages. It was cool to see. The best way to get involved is to download the OutVote app and tell your friends to do the same. We need as many people as possible, not only committed to voting this year, but committed to peer pressuring their friends into voting. You have to hold everyone accountable. It's an easy thing to ask your friends. They won't be annoyed, I promise. You can also get involved by emailing us at team@outvote.io if you know any awesome Democratic candidates we should put on the app that are missing right now. And finally, you can actually donate on our website, www.outvote.io, to help us raise money to do this for free for candidates who either can't afford it or don't have enough volunteering power to kind of make it happen themselves. Thanks.
And that's it for this week's episode of We Rebel podcast. As always, please feel free to contact us if you have any questions for the two of us or our guests at WeRebelPodcast@gmail.com.
And you can find us on all the social medias at We Rebel Podcast, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
See everybody next week.
I'm Max Lasser, the host of The Calories, a three-episode podcast miniseries about making weight loss easier. After I lost 100 pounds by calorie counting in 2015, I started to realize why the way I was doing it before, just eating healthy and exercising, wasn't working for me. The podcast features experts from Mount Sinai Hospital, Mayo Clinic, and more, and you can check it out October 1st from Campfire Media on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are found.
Campfire.